Accession number 9474, reel 5. George Harbottle, reel 5. After Hooge, where did you go from Hooge?
We went to some trenches at the Menin Gate, which is on the Zillebeke Railway, and we were doing working parties up the Zillebeke Railway.
And when would that be? When did you leave Hooge, roughly speaking?
That would be in June, I suppose.
1915?
Yes. May, I should think. Probably May. May, June.
So, you were in dugouts, trenches near the Menin Gate.
Yes.
This work you were doing on the Zillebeke Railway, could you describe it in a little more detail?
Well, I'll give you, we said, for instance, I'll give you an incident if it's any interest. We went, we were marched with a guide up the Zillebeke Railway, to go to a working party. We didn't know where, but it was the engineers would spitlock the task, and then you did the digging. But it happened one day. We were going along there one night, and the Zillebeke Railway had an embankment on the east side and a declivity on the other side. And this particular night, I was the rear platoon, and one of my fellows, who was a spectacled individual, he tripped up, sprained his ankle, broke his spectacles, and he's nearly blind as a bat without them. And I said, "Well, I've got to look." I said to the corporal ahead of me, "I said, look, I'm going to take this chap back into some dugouts just in the embankment, and dump him there, and I'll pick him up when we come back." So I did that, and shoved him in among some people that were in the dugout there, and I said, "I'll pick you up when I come back," and I went on to catch the company up. And at that moment, a shell came down, landed on the railway, within, a couple of yards of me, and blew me up against the embankment. And I was out for the count, or I thought I was. As a matter of fact, I thought I was dead, but I wasn't. I wondered, I thought, this is rather interesting. Where do we go from here? Another salvo came over, about four of them, about 10 yards away, and I knew perfectly well I wasn't dead. And I got myself struggled together and hopped away from where the shells were dropping. And I was in a fairly battered condition. I was absolutely deaf as a result of the explosion. And I got back, and some REs were in a dugout there, and they pulled me in, and they gave me hot tea and rum, and that revived me, and I was all right again in about half an hour. But I didn't know where the company had gone. But there was a call for stretcher bearers. There was a fellow with a broken leg, and these REs said, "Come on, we've got to help this fellow in." So we hadn't a stretcher, but we got a door. And so the four of us went out and got this chap onto the door and carried him in. He was a big Scotsman. Blowing weight he was, too. And then the REs knew where to get in contact with the ambulance, and an ambulance came up and took him away. And eventually I got back to our place at Menin Gate.
Did this being blown up in that fashion, Did it leave you shaky or in any way suffering from any of the symptoms of shell shock?
No. No, but I was, I mean, I didn't have any shell shock because I thought I was out for the count. I was wondering where I was going. and when I did struggle together, and I'd been half an hour with the REs and had some hot tea, I was all right.
Now, what work were you doing? You used to go out on these working parties up the Zillibeck Railway. You weren't actually working on the railway, were
no,
you?
No, it was simply a means of a direction to get to wherever the working party was, but I don't know where it was.
What sort of ground conditions were there in the sector at that
time? Pretty wet. You didn't dig very far down or deep without getting into water.
Was the ground yet pocked with shell holes, or was it still
no, not very much then.
How long were you doing these working parties?
About a fortnight.
And this was the usual work of digging communication trenches and such like?
Yes.
Where did you go after that then?
We were pulled back behind Ypres to Vlamertinge. And we were delighted to hear that we were moving to somewhere away from Ypres. It was then that that we went to Loka.
Where's Loka? Where is
near
Loka?
Kemmel, near Kemmel Hill. It was just a village there, and the trenches there that we were in were not dug down. They were merely barricades, because the ground was so wet you couldn't dig down, and they were hardly bulletproof.
What sort of effect did artillery have on them then?
Oh well, blast them to hell if they hit them. And the trouble was, we got quite a lot of trench mortars.
That's where you first
came. The case.
What kind of trench mortars were they at this stage?
They weren't as heavy as the subsequent trench mortars, but they would come. You knew perfectly well. One Cobra come over, there'd be a whole lot more, because a trench mortar unit would come up into the German line and shoot about half a dozen trench mortars off and then hop it and leave the trouble to the people that are in the line. We were the same way. If we had a trench mortar crew came up, we weren't very pleased to see them, because we knew perfectly well they'd hoi the mortars up and then we'd get the aftermath.
So you were in this area, you were still just a normal sergeant?
No, by that time I'd become company quartermaster sergeant.
Was that because of a casualty?
Yes.
Could you explain what your responsibilities were as CQMS?
Well, CQMS, you're responsible for all the pay books. You had to settle what a man was due to on his pay. Had to have a strength record of all the platoons and sections. You had to make up the rations that you draw your rations from the your regimental quartermaster sergeant according to your strength. And put them up into sandbags in the quantity of what is appropriate per unit. And then when you've done all that, then the transport would assemble at night, and you'd go up with the transport. Sandbags would be put onto the limbers, and you had to walk with your limber up to the line. And then when you got up to the line, to the dump, carrying parties would come down, and from each from their own company, and they would carry the stuff up, and you'd go up with them. The transport would go away then, and you'd go up with the ration party, and with any mail there happened to be, and any newspapers there happened to be, and you'd see the company sergeant major, and each of the sections came for their rations, and then see if there are any letters to collect, go and see the company commander, get a list of any casualties, and then in the early hours of the morning sling your rifle over your shoulder and get yourself back again to the transport lines.
Where were the transport lines usually?
Well, they would be probably a mile behind the front line. You'd have to find your way down there. Well, you soon learnt where that was.
Just a couple of points. Looking after the pay books for the company and you know maintaining the records of the strength of the company, did you need any clerical assistance for that, or did you have any clerical assistance? Because it sounds
Well, not really, no clerical assistance, but we did have what was called a dumper. In other words, a man who, while you were up the line, he would be gathering the rations for the next lot and getting them. He had your lists, and he would be putting them up in the sandbag so that when you came back again, you could get a bit of sleep and then go off with the transport again the next night. And he, in some cases, could do a bit of clerical work.
When would you do the pay books? What did you have to do connected?
Oh, well, every man carried his own pay book. But I had to have a record of each man, and I made a record of what was in his pay book, because some of them got more pay than another, for the reason that some had given allotments to a wife or to a mother, or had nobody to give an allotment to, and therefore they got their full pay, whereas the others got deductions because of the allotments they'd made. So you had to know all about that.
Was proficiency pay paid out as well?
Yes, but it didn't come at that time. And it was a little time later than that, I got a copy of King's Regulations. And I started reading up in King's Regulations, and I realized that it was part of King's Regulations that they got efficiency pay once they had been 6 months on active service. And hell, we'd been on 6 months active service, and everybody's entitled to extra pay. And so I took this up to the company commander, and I drew his attention to the fact that... and he said, "Shh, keep quiet about that." He said, "We'll get onto this straight away. And but you don't tell the other companies." And, so we did, and we got the he put an application in on the necessary form, which it gives you there, and so all of A Company were getting proficiency pay. Nobody else was. There was, so I can assure you, there was hell on the battalion before very long.
What about extra pay for things like rifle shooting business? Because I believe they got extra pay if they were a marksman
and that sort of thing. Well, there was if they were marksmen, they were. If they weren't, there was no tests of marksmanship there.
So nobody could go for that sort of thing anymore. Now, these records you kept, would they be in a ledger?
No, they would be in a notebook.
Just a normal notebook.
Where I could keep a record of what was going on.
Well, did you have any when did you have any responsibility to tell anybody when a company or a platoon or something was getting low in strength? Would you deal with that?
No, that had nothing to do with me. That was the adjutant.
Had you had your replacements in to keep you up to strength yet?
We got one or two lightly wounded back again, but there was no big influx as yet.
So what would you say the strength of the battalion was during this period?
Well, the battalion would be, I don't suppose we were more than about 200 before. We'd probably got it up to about 350.
Now, when you were making up the sandbags, how did you go about that? Would it be a set amount for each man? Or of the rations, was there a set amount for each man, and you just put that in?
No, we'd put a sandbag for a section for the total number of men there, and they could sort it out themselves.
And how would you decide what to give them? Was it just what was available, or was
the proportion of what was available?
Were you able to usually send them the basic amount of rations, or would sometimes you be short? Would there just not be enough food available?
No, we're generally pretty well on.
When you were leading the ration parties up and with the transport to, you know, up to the dump, were you interfered a lot with by artillery? Because I believe they used to search the roads and the...
At this particular place there was one particular instance which would probably be of interest to you. We used to go up until dusk. We would stop on the road at a point where we didn't go over the hill, where we could be observed, until it was dark. But there was one night, as we were going up, there was a German sausage balloon with the observer in, you know, and you could see him at the right as we were going up. And I said to others, I said, that fella, if we can see him, he can see us. I said, there's going to be trouble here. And as we were just about ready to move over the top, an 18-pounder team trotted up, who were much faster than we were, you see, because we were mules, they went on ahead of us, as they got into the village, there was a village and a stream that we were going down into to go up to the trenches, and there was a salvo came down, and one of the shells, high explosive shells, burst on the roadside and cut the traces of the leading pair of horses without damaging. It killed one horse, a wheeler, but the two in front with a young chap on it. The traces were cut, and they were terrified, and they shot off with him on board, and they missed the bridge and went down into the stream, and two of us who were spare men, like quartermaster sergeants, we went off to try and help this lad, because we knew he was caught somewhere. The horses were in the water, and he was caught in the trees, and we pulled him up and gathered him up and found that he had a broken leg, and he was just a youngster, and he was in a terrible state because he thought he'd lost his leg, and he took an awful lot of convincing that he hadn't lost his leg, it was only broken, and we bandaged him up and put a splint on, and the gunners had then got themselves remarkably quickly organized. They'd got the horses out of the water. One of them, the put in as a wheeler, and the other one on, And they said to this chap, look, we'll, the battery's not far away, we'll come straight back and pick you up on our way back again. So that, and then on we went. But they would pick him up and take him back home, and he got a good blighty one there.
Would you get many instances of artillery falling near you?
Oh yes, there was shelling. There wasn't a great deal of shelling in that area, but when we were in Ypres, it was shelling every night.
Had you been acting as CQMS at Ypres at all?
Subsequent to this.
Subsequently, right.
Because we moved back to Ypres from here, you see.
This is when your front line was at Whitchurch Ridge.
That's right. Yes.
How long did you stay there?
We were there for about, I should think, about 3 months.
In and out between Logan.
Yes, that's right.
Whitechurch Ridge. Well, the men you had driving the wagons with the food on, were they regimental or company men, or were they Army Service Corps?
No, they were. It was battalion transport.
And whose command would they be under?
Under the transport officer and the transport sergeant. Actually, Major Clayton was he was Captain Clayton in those days. But he was the transport officer all the time that I was a CQMS, and I couldn't think of a finer man to be with in times of shelling or anything else. He was absolutely imperturbable.
How did you work with him? What was the nature of your... How did you?
He was quite clear and definite with so far as what he called spare men were concerned. He had no responsibility for us whatsoever. He was responsible for the transport, and we had nothing to do with his transport. We happened to interfere. But if there's any shelling and we had to clear out, we had to go and look after ourselves. He was quite clear and definite about that, and we happened to mess about with his transport.
Would he how would you get the right amount of transport for the food you needed to the rations you needed to transport?
There would be he would have at his disposal four limbers and a GS wagon, general service wagon, and as it was rare that you took the GS wagon up unless there was any heavy material to take up. The limbers, all the rations and small arms and ammunition, anything of that kind, went in the limbers.
And it would be one limber per company, would it?
As a rule, in all probability, the limbers were two in pairs, you see. And so there would be... two limbers was all that was needed, because that'd give you your four spaces.
It would all go onto two limbers for the four companies.
Yes, so there'd be two of you with each limber, one for the front one, one for the back one. We'd be walking at the back of them, and so we weren't allowed to ride on them. Not on your life.
The four company quartermaster sergeants, yes, would be walking along. Why weren't you allowed to ride on them?
How what?
Why weren't you allowed to ride on them?
The mokes had enough to do without bakshi men. The men could walk.
You said it was donkeys you had, not
well. They weren't. No, mules.
Mules. Sorry. Yes. What were mules like? Were they? I mean, obviously you didn't have much to do with them, but were they an effective mechanism?
Well, they were, but of course a mule is a very difficult thing to handle. And they can be bloody awkward.
Why were
But the transport men soon learned how to handle a mule, and if you treated a mule decently, he was a good servant.
Why were mules chosen instead of the horses that seemed to have done more?
Because a mule is much hardier. It'll stand up to evil conditions in a way a horse won't. And you see, a light draft horse that is for limbers, which we had originally, they're expensive. And It was felt you shouldn't use horse flesh, but that sort of thing. You needed your horse flesh for your guns.
Were there any other responsibilities or aspects of your job as CQMS you can think of?
Well, we had nothing to do with the transport.
But what did you have anything? Is there anything we haven't covered about the duties you did have?
No, that's pretty well covered. The general duties you had.
So, was it which did you prefer? It's a silly question, really. Would you rather have been a sergeant in the line, doing regimental duty, battalion duties, or would you rather have been doing this quartermaster?
Well, I preferred the CQMS because it was more up my street in the question of the clerical side of it that I was doing, and I felt that I was doing a job that a lot of individuals couldn't do. For that reason, and I felt I was in the right place.
Would you be able to? Would you work to try and get extra things for your company in any way you could? I mean, were there any fiddles, or would you try and get extra food?
No, there's nothing much you could get. You're all treated the same.
So there was no sort of scope for imagination?
No,
there was
no scope for any initiative of that kind. The extra duty pay was the only thing that I got for them.
So you were at Whitesheet Ridge and at Loke. When did you move from there? You were there 3 months.
We moved from there somewhere about November or December to Ypres again. We were based on Dicky Bush.
That was where your transport.
That was
lines
where the transport lines were. And where the men were in huts if they were out of the line. You see, there was part of the battalion in the line and part of it at the rest camp, which was just huts. They'd swap over.
Which bit of the line were they in?
This is when we're up at Hill 60.
What did you see much of what conditions were like on Hill 60?
Oh yes, because you're there every night.
What impression did you gain of it then?
Well, I mean, it was just life in the line, and there wasn't much different from any other daily life that you lived in the line. There was one occasion when, there was a little stream running down at Hill 60 throughout our trench, and that was the drinking water. And one foggy day, the thick fog, as you did occasionally get there, somebody went scrounging around in no man's land. And they found a Scotsman and a German that had been at each other, and they were lying in the stream that we were drinking out of.
How did you react to that sort of thing, that sort of horror of war? Were you becoming
That was just a laugh.
Now, was that your nature before you'd been in trench warfare for that? I mean, is that how you originally took the horrors of war? Or was it a process of acclimatisation and hardening?
Oh, acclimatisation.
So you didn't start off.
We didn't. No. You were damn lucky to be alive.